Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Researching the history on early pro teams is nothing better when you have one of the original APFA or NFL teams. And today, we have Joe Ziemba joining us on the program once again to talk about the Hammond Pros, a team very familiar to Joe and his research on the history of Chicago football. Coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. And in our continual quest to find out about the early pro football teams, we stumbled upon another one that we'd love to talk about. And we have our expert, our old friend Joe Ziemba, is back once again to talk about a team that he knows quite a bit about, the Hammond Pros. Joe Ziemba, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thank you, Darren. You are too kind with those words. And as I mentioned to you earlier, we'll probably try and stumble through this, but the Hammond team is a unique one, started by a boxer, taken over by a doctor. One of the owners had his players had him arrested, and they even tried to get a Hollywood star to help him out on the front line. So this is an intriguing team and one that sadly wasn't very successful in the National Football League.
Well, sounds like we got a little bit of everything that's going to happen here. This is going to be a good one. I can feel it.
So it's a team that's got a little bit of history. We know them as the Hammond Pros from when they started with the NFL in 1920. But teams in that area, Hammond is really closer to Chicago than a lot of the Chicago suburbs. In fact, you may not know that Hammond was renamed Homan for a little movie called A Christmas Story. And so when you hear downtown Homan, even though it wasn't filmed there, that was Hammond, Indiana. That was the movie took place in the original book. So enough of my theatrical trivia. But the team goes back, founded by a boxer named Jimmy Clabby, and he started the Clabby Athletic Club. And then this goes way back to the beginning of the last century when he got things started. And the team played back in around 1905 through about 1915. And then Jimmy decided to get out of football, and the team was turned over to a couple of local entrepreneurs. Paul Pardone and his partner owned a fuel company in Hammond, Indiana. And around 1915, they took the team over with a lot of ambition. And Pardone was a very ambitious guy, like I said, an entrepreneur, an innovative person. And he had a little bit of a marketing background. And so some of the things we'll talk about today were the result of his great ideas for trying to make football successful in a rather small town. So he was, Paul Pardone, we first hear about him in the local newspapers as the manager of the City Fuels baseball team in 1915. That's the company he owned. He was still a young man in his early 20s, but he was also involved in trying to bring hockey to Hammond, even before football. Again, that was in 1915. And that December, we see him show up in the local newspapers as receiving a permit to construct a restroom at the outdoor hockey rink in Hammond. So he was always thinking that if people came to the game, maybe they could use a rest stop, a restroom to enjoy the game a little more. So he was always thinking. In 1916, as a manager of his baseball team, he led that team to the Hammond City title. And there were teams that played baseball, came in from around the area, from Crown Point and Gary, Indiana, even the far Southern reaches a Chicago one over to Hammond because it's that close to Chicago. It's basically right over the state line. And he started leasing the Hammond Athletic Park, or owning it, I think. So he was leasing it out to other football teams for $75 a game, which put a lot of the teams, forcing them to find another place to play because that was too much money. And later on, he put a bid in for the Clabby's Athletic Club, and that would have been about 1916 when that was finalized. And finally, he was the owner of a football team as the 1916 season wound down.
That's covering quite a bit of ground there. The boxer had that team for quite a while. So he I guess you could almost consider he's a football man.
Right, exactly, yes. And one of the earlier teams in Hammond was called the Iroquois Club. And we don't hear much about them, but they gave way to the Hammond Clabbies. And it's interesting because some of this early history, there isn't much written about it. I spent some time at the Hammond Public Library, which is great. They have archives of their history. And of course, when the NFL celebrated its 100th anniversary a year or so ago, Hammond being one of the original teams was one of the stops that the television stations made to recognize some of the smaller towns like Hammond and then Rock Island that were part of the NFL before it became the NFL. So the league itself, or I should say the team, once Mr. Pardone got a hold of it, he was paying the players quite a bit of money. And for 1917, he even attracted Paddy Driscoll, a name very familiar to pro football fans. He played at Northwestern and also played with the Chicago Cubs baseball team. And because of his time with the Cubs, Northwestern found out about it. Very difficult for them not to find out about it since it was right in the same neighborhood. And Paddy wasn't allowed to play football his final year. So he went over to Hammond to play. And they had a real good team, which won the title, the Midwest title, I believe was called. And the team in Hammond was so popular that there would be 10 and 12 coach special trains that would follow the Hammond. They called them the professionals back then, to their battles in Fort Wayne or Lafayette or Pine Village, which were all in Indiana at the time. And there was a real rivalry between Pine Village and Hammond where a lot of betting went on. Hard to believe that would even happen. But the Hammond Times once said that regarding that rivalry, that thousands of dollars changed hands on the outcome of the football game. But Pardoon had even bigger ideas, and in 1918 and 1919, he kind of expanded his idea to become a more regional or even national football team. He didn't play many home games because the fields weren't very big there, but he was the first to lease what we now know as Wrigley Field in Chicago so that Hammond could play its games there. And they were a team that even when they entered the NFL, pretty much did not play any games in Hammond. So they were called the Hammond Pros when they entered the league, but didn't spend much time in Hammond. But Pardone was always looking for some kind of advantage. And he figured the best thing he could do to make money was to attract fans, which he did by playing at Cubs Park and trying to schedule some of the bigger teams to come along. And as I mentioned, the team was paid well at the end of the 1916 season. This is going to sound really smallish at the time, but the team made $2,000, and there are 20 people involved with the football team. So they all got $100, and since they played 10 games, they figured the players were quite wealthy. They made $10 a game back in 1916. And that's when Paul Pardone kind of took over. And what he did was, as I mentioned, trying to make some marketing innovations. One was in 1917. He was disappointed when his Hammond team had a really bad game. I think it was against Pine Village. They lost 21 to 6. And I don't know where he got this idea, Darren, but he thought that Hollywood actor Douglas Fairbanks would be a great addition to his team. And if he was looking for publicity, he certainly got it. He fired off a telegram after that Pine Village disaster and said, "Dear Doug, we'll pay you $1,000 and expenses to play with Hammond football next week against Fort Wayne here on Sunday. It's our annual game, an intense rivalry. Need your pep. Wire me, collect. Signed, Paul Pardon.
Wow.
Of course, Mr. Fairbanks looked at that and he said, I'm very sorry, but previous arrangements necessitate my declining your kind offer. Hope you have a great game. Regards, Douglas Fairbanks. And the publicity he got was not all positive. People were wondering other newspapers what the heck he was trying to do by getting an actor to play football for Hammond. In fact, the Hammond Times, which was a big supporter of him, was saying that maybe one of the ways to be successful in pro football in 1917 is to offer some celebrity who has a press agent so you can get your name in the paper. Then the second thing you should do is find out where you can borrow $1,000 quickly in case he accepts. And third, with Hammond being so close to Chicago, they said, watch out for the Chicago Eggmen. When they learn you have $1,000, you don't know what to do with. So that was kind of the local reaction. And he did get the name of the football team in papers around the country because of that.
Well, imagine what a great marketing ploy that would have been, though, if he would have got Fairbanks to come and play. He probably would have made that money back because he would have, you know, people would have come to the game just to see, hey, I saw Douglas Fairbanks today.
You That's know? Right.
Put some fannies in the seats.
You know, I think maybe some of the same thinking took place when the owners got together in 1920 and named Jim Thorpe their president. Here was a guy who was a nationwide name, but certainly did not have the business experience to run a football league, which proved right. true. But with that name recognition, that did give them some publicity in the papers. And speaking of Jim Thorpe, the biggest thing that Paul Pardon and the Hammond Pros could offer those thinking of a professional league was in 1919, when the teams were able to get a game together at Wrigley Field in Chicago, and 12,000 people showed up for that. And I think a lot of people around the Midwest said, wow, maybe this pro football thing will work, especially some of the owners. 12,000 attendance at a football game, a pro game. Of course, colleges were drawing a lot more than that, but the pros were lucky to get 500, maybe 1,000 people. And one of the memories about that was that Thorpe came back in 1928 or so and played one more game in Hammond when he was out of shape. And the newspaper hinted, well, they didn't hint. They wrote down that there was a smell of whiskey on his breath. So that's not my quote. That's from the Hammond Times back in 1937 when someone recollected that. So I'm wandering off track here a little bit. But the important thing about the Hammond Pros is even though they weren't all that successful in football, the marketing that Paul Pardon brought about really helped get some recognition for the team. And the game with Jim Thorpe at Wrigley Field in Chicago, which was called Cubs Park, showed that the professionals could attract a big crowd. But the biggest impact that probably the pros made was in 1919. And this is a famous team that's called the $20,000 All-Stars. The name in 1919 for Hammond was called the Bobcats, but they also took on the name of the All-Stars because they truly had an all-star team. The biggest name was George Halas. Later went on, of course, to found the Chicago Bears after a stint with the Decatur Staleys, which evolved into the Bears. So in 1919, they had this great team, included Hugh Blacklock of Michigan State, Milt Gee from Dartmouth, Shorty Desjardins from the University of Chicago. The fullback and coach was Dick King from Harvard, guard Jerry Jones. And, of course, Halas was teamed with his former teammate, Paddy Driscoll, who joined the team later in the year. So we had a pretty powerful team. And they got the name the $20,000 Stars because that was their payroll, which is unprecedented again. They didn't really play any home games, but he was offering a very nice salary. In fact, George Halas had said that he was done with football after he completed his 1918 stint with the Great Lakes football team, which won the Rose Bowl. And he played some baseball. The big story about the New York Yankees, he could do everything but hit the curveball. And he wrote in his autobiography, though, that after the baseball season was over, that talking about football, I ached for the excitement of a good game, for the competition, for the challenge to the muscles, for the joy of victory. And then Hammond offered him $50 a game. He was making $45 a week as an engineer in Chicago. So he took the job and got back into football. And the All-Stars had a fairly decent season, except there were some heartaches and hardships. For example, they went to Detroit to play a game. Again, back in 1919, there was no league and no rules. And with both teams on hand and a pretty good crowd of 3,000 in the stands, the game was canceled by the Detroit management. And the Hammond Times couldn't figure this out. They were still supportive of the team, but why they could cancel a game with both teams there, and Hammond had come all the way up from Indiana to play it. So the Hammond Times gave one of those first examples of the media going after a team, saying the behavior of the Detroit manager in calling off the game was the worst we have ever seen in years. There was no hilarity among the Hammond players or the fans who made this trip. The real remorseful person on the trip was Paul Pardun, the Hammond club owner, who quietly ducked to a corner to write out checks for his stars. And before the big games in Chicago start, it is costing Pardun a neat little fortune. So as an owner, he was still paying his players, even though he didn't receive a cent from Detroit back in those days. And that eventually caught up with him towards the end of the 1919 season. Paul started writing bad checks, and his players did not appreciate it. They had him arrested. So he spent a couple of days in jail in Oak Park, Illinois, a western suburb of Chicago. The players were irate. They had him arrested. The newspaper said it was alleged that the checks running from $100 to $250, with which he had paid his players on November 26, were returned from the bank marked no funds. Pardun's bond was placed at $12,000, in default of which he was remanded to jail. So, again, this hurt pro football as much as the game with Thorpe had been a blessing. This was a black eye, and the paper in Evansville said, such stuff like this, which is writing bad checks, will give professional football a black eye at the very start. And eventually, Paul got out of jail. The team finished its season. And then that version of the Hammond Pros disbanded. Some of the players went down to Decatur with Alice. Some became members of the short-lived Chicago Tigers. And then still another version of the Hammond Pros arrived in 1920, this time under the leadership of Dr. Elva A. Young, who had been a trainer for the team and probably a part owner when Paul Pardun ran the team there in the late teens of 1900. So Elva Young was part of that organizational meeting in 1920 for the what became the NFL. And once again, the Pros were a visiting team, even in their own hometown. They only played one regular season game in Hammond, and that was in 1923, before the team was suspended in 1926. So through 1920 through 1926, Dr. Elva Young ran the team. Not really successful in their tenure in the league. They only played three or four games a year, going 5-26-4. And at that time in 26, that's when the new Red Grange League started, and the NFL was trying to retaliate by having stronger cities represented. And there was a feeling in Hammond that the team was forced out because of the size of the city. But also, there really wasn't the finances or the talent for the Hammond Pros to continue successfully. So that's a brief nutshell of the Hammond Pros from the early 1900s to 1926.
Joe, did they ever find out why they canceled that game in 1919 in Detroit?
Yeah, he said it was the manager admitted there was a lack of fans. He wanted more people. And again, It doesn't make sense. The weather was kind of bad. Apparently it rained. But to call off a game right before it starts, thinking you get better attendance, as you know, that's going to create a lot of ill will with your home fans.
Right.
As well as giving you that bad reputation for anyone else who might venture to Detroit to play a game.
Yeah, they're probably not going to want to schedule a Detroit next time around, that's for sure.
Right.
Or at least travel to Detroit anyway. So, very interesting. Very well done. Now, you said Hammond must be real close to Gary, Indiana, then?
Hammond and Gary are pretty much next to each other. I think Gary is a little east of Hammond. As you come out of Chicago along the lakefront, you'll hit Hammond first, then you'll hit Gary.
Okay. I know when I come to Chicago from out east here, I know we go through Gary, and it seems like we get on that, I forget what the bridge is, the Sky Bridge, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah.
Interstate 90, Skyway Bridge. Yeah. And seems like you're Gary, and then you're on that bridge, and you're Chicago. So must be right in there somewhere. I have to pay attention next time.
It's a great shortcut, and if you take out a second or third mortgage, you can afford the Skyway to go on it. Probably right, the most expensive toll road around. In fact, there was a neat story I found about Gary. This was written in 1937, but the Hammond newspaper was giving a summary of the history of the team, and one of the things they were proud of was the great Newt Rockne. They said played for the Gary Professionals in 1914 or something. I think when he was still at Notre Dame, but they claimed he played, and the Gary team won 3 touchdowns to 2 touchdowns, which is an unusual way of keeping score. But that was back before both of us, Darren.
Well, yeah. Well, Newt must have been pretty busy too, because he played for Massillon, I believe, too, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, he was a busy boy before he got to Notre Dame. Now, Joe, how far away is Decatur from Chicago and Hammond?
Yeah, let's see. I don't know the exact miles, but I would think about an hour and a half, so maybe 90 miles or so.
Okay. I was just trying to think.
Train rides connected everything.
I'm just trying to think how close, 1920, you had, Decatur, you had Hammond, and, of course, the Cardinals, and they had to be pretty close proximity for everybody. It had to be almost like, Canton, Akron, and Massillon didn't play in the APFA, but Cleveland, I guess, did. But they a lot of close teams there. So very interesting. Very well done.
Rock Island, it's almost like a triangle between Rock Island and Decatur, and then Chicago and Hammond for those three spots, with Decatur being south and Rock Island west, and Chicago and Hammond on the east part of that triangle.
Also, Rock Island's fairly close to Chicago also then.
I think it's probably about 100 miles west.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
On the western edge of Illinois, yep.
All right. Well, hey, we got an education on Hammond and the geography of Chicagoland. So that's
and most of it's probably inaccurate. So I apologize.
So there's people at home getting out their GPS and say, it's 102 miles, not 100. Well, that's close enough for me. That gives me the general geography of the terrain there. So definitely greatly appreciate that. Now, we haven't got a chance to speak to you in a while, been probably about a month or so. What do you have cooking on When Football Was Football podcast?
We have some interesting stories, I think. The one currently running, which will be up in the early part of November, depending on which this show airs, is about the Cardinals and Packers rivalry, the second oldest in the NFL. But then the following episode was one I really had a lot of fun with. It's about the meanest man in football, Ed Sprinkle of the Bears, who just made the Hall of Fame this past year. I wanted to find out, is Ed Sprinkle really that mean? And I think he was. He was. But he also played as much as he could within the rules. And as one of his teammates said, if the whistle hasn't blown, Ed is going to go after you. But I was thinking of someone huge, maybe like a Lyle Alzado or something, but Sprinkle was just about 6 feet tall and 206 pounds soaking wet. And yet he wreaked havoc in the havoc way before we used to call what we call now a sax. And then following that episode will be a focus on the oldest rivalry in the NFL prior to their meeting on December 5th of 2021. That's the Bears and Cardinals rivalry. So we hope to have some fun stories in on that as well.
Well, looking forward to both of those. And I've listened to the Packers Cardinals podcast that you had out, and it's extremely well done as always. So good job on that. So make sure listeners, if you haven't checked that out, go to Sports History Network and When Football Was Football with Joe Ziemba. So Joe, thank you once again for joining us, and hope to have you on again real soon.
Oh, Darren, we look forward to that. And thank you for what you're doing for bringing back the history of the National Football League and all these forgotten heroes that many of us have not heard about and their teams. So thank you.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.